Good evening, everyone. We are going to get this evening's plenary session started. My name is Mary Ferreter, and I am humbled and honored to be the president of AFCC this year. On behalf of AFCC Board of Directors and the Conference Committee, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the seventh International Symposium on Child Custody Evaluations. For anyone who this is their first time at an AFCC conference, I welcome you specially and tell you that you are in for quite a treat. AFCC conferences may not have all the answers, but we certainly have all the questions. And I think tonight you're going to realize that we do have the questions, that we do want to discuss and debate and explore all the options to those issues that are near and dear to our hearts when we do child custody evaluations and dealing with children and families in the courts in general. Many of you, I'm told, have ribbons that are pink, which means that you're a new member. If you have a pink ribbon, would you stand so that we can welcome you accordingly? We're thrilled to have so many new members. Thank you for joining us. I'm sure that you will learn to know how important AFCC will be in your practice and in your lives. For those who are not AFCC members, I want to let you know that, first and foremost, this should be your organization of choice. We really are a wonderful family, and it's really an honor to be part of this group. You will learn things at AFCC conferences that you will use in your practical life, and it really, I think, is an organization that answers all of the issues, or at least discusses all the issues that we face in our day-to-day lives. The new member special, for those who are attending the conference, there's a special rate for an AFCC membership that is only good during the conference itself. So if you like what you see in the next couple of days, please stop at the registration desk and become an AFCC member. I have to give certain announcements this evening. Taste of Atlanta, which is joining some of your colleagues, getting to know other AFCC members. They go out to restaurants in the area. That will happen on Friday night. If you'd like to be part of Taste of Atlanta, there are sign-up sheets. And when you're out, you just need to sign up before lunch tomorrow afternoon. So join some of your colleagues, and we'll have a good time out in Atlanta nightlife on Friday night. If you need continuing education credits, you need to sign in and out of all of the sessions. And if you want more information on continuing ed credits, just stop at the registration desk and they can give you that information. I also want to promote and brag about the fabulous conference, the annual conference, the 44th annual AFCC conference that's coming up at the Capitol Hilton in Washington, D.C. It will be held from May 30th through June 2nd. We will have the Capitol Steps as part of the performance, the entertainment. And if you haven't heard the Capitol Steps, you really should come to Washington to hear them because they are just dynamite. I'd also like to ask you now, if you would, to silence your cell phones. I don't care if you shut them off or put them on vibrate, but we really don't want to have them going off. And as I'm saying this, I'm thinking, I don't think I silenced mine. So you'll hear mine go off when I sit down. I think that takes care of all of the preliminary matters. Now I'd like to start tonight, which is the first of the three great debates in child custody evaluations. As you know, the AFCC board passed the model standards for child custody evaluation in May of 2006. They were actually an update of our old model standards. These were not done in a vacuum. AFCC appointed a task force. They had three public forums. One was in Nashville at the last international symposium before the drafting got underway. Then in Seattle, a draft was discussed and debated. And then in Breckenridge, there was another public forum. In total, about 200 people participated in those public forums. Not only were there with AFCC-sponsored events, but there were also two public internet postings that produced over 600 comments to the task force, a daunting task for anyone to undertake. The task force produced 9 different drafts as they discussed, debated, analyzed, and tried to come up with a consensus for best practice in child custody evaluations. Their discussions and debate have led to some of the questions that we are posing in these debates over this symposium. And tonight's issue is, do child custody evaluation model standards help or hinder the practice? Will they create better educated judges, more thoughtful court orders, raise the level of practice among the child custody evaluators? Or will they give lawyers an extra tool for cross-examination? And frankly, is that bad? And will they create malpractice suits and board complaints for the evaluators? We have asked in tonight's debates that people take on specific roles, whether it is their personal feelings or not. We have asked that people stay in those roles and not, as many of our AFCC members would, sort of mediate their positions and change along the way. What we have asked is that people stay in those roles for theater's sake so that we can really debate and discuss the issues. And now it is my privilege to introduce the panel for tonight and the moderator as well. First and foremost, we have Arnie Scheinvolt, who is a psychologist and custody evaluator and mediator and a member of the AFCC Task Force on Model Standards for Child Custody Evaluation. Arnie's going to be the moderator for this evening, asking all the tough questions. Then we have Diana Gould-Saltzman. She is a certified family law specialist, a fellow of the American Academy of Family Lawyers, and a member of the AFCC Task Force on AFCC Task Force on Model Standards for Child Custody Evaluators. Could we have chosen a smaller name for this task force? Then we have David Martindale, who is the psychological consultant, and the reporter for the AFCC Task Force. And behind me, who I've been hiding here, is Nancy Versteeg, who is associate professor at the William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. And then if I move over here, you'll be able to see Mary Connell, who is a psychologist and custody evaluator and is leading the current APA effort to revise their child custody evaluation guidelines. So I will get off the stage and let Arnie take over. We will let you know that there will be an opportunity for questions, and I will be roaming later to give mics to people to ask questions. And Arnie is going to be very strong about making sure that they are questions, because we do want to keep this a debate.
Right. We are going to conduct this in such a manner that I will be posing a question to one side or the other, and they will have a certain period of time to give a response. You may or may not be able to see it, but once it's lit up, you will. There is a set of lights in front of them. They will get the green light in order to have time to do their response. When they have 30 seconds left, a yellow light will start flashing. And when it's time to stop, a red light will come on. If at that point they decide they don't want to stop, they will then hear this. And that will be their absolute signal to stop. Now, it's important that you all have heard that sound, because we are going to give you an opportunity to ask questions during this debate, to become the moderator. However, if for some reason you should get the idea that you have more to say than just a question, you may hear the cow. And if you hear the moo, then Mary will kind of take the microphone and we'll move on to another question. But we do want you to get involved, and that's the way we'll move forward from here. Distinguished panelists, are you ready?
We are.
Good. I think where we're going to start tonight is I'm going to ask a question of Nancy and Mary in kind of a preliminary beginning. And that is, Mary, given, especially for Mary, given your connection with the APA, we know that APA has guidelines while AFCC has gone to model standards. Perhaps you could help us understand the distinction that APA was making or would have made in those two terms.
Yes, thank you, Arnie. The American Psychological Association has developed a very kind of clear bifurcation on these two issues. Standards are considered, according to APA parlance, to refer to specific forms of professional behavior, endeavor, or effort that are mandatory, and that in a specified professional situation, they're expected. And if you don't emit these behaviors, these mandatory behaviors, then there's an enforcement mechanism. There are teeth in the standards. There's a specified punishment, and often there's an ethics board set up to deal with complaints. Whereas in APA parlance, guidelines are more aspirational in intent. They're intended to support or assist the professional in delivering good services. They have an educational value, and they allow for and respect the role of professional judgment. APA is loath to generate a great many standards. The ethical code is both the aspirational principles and the standards of practice, the code of conduct that is expected of psychologists. And beyond that, there aren't a great many sets of standards currently being promulgated by APA. APA does generate guidelines. The Committee on Professional Practices and Standards, of which I'm currently outgoing chair, oversees the guidelines development. Various parts of constituencies within APA can promote their own guidelines, and COPS is there to assist them in being sure that the language in those guidelines is guideline language. Guideline language is the psychologist might want to consider, the psychologist may wish to look at these resources. Very sort of supportive language. There are no shoulds, oughts, musts, sort of like Albert Ellis got into the picture. And standards are, by contrast, full of sort of declarative statements. Psychologists will, psychologists must, psychologists do these things. And so one of the ways that APA distinguishes between guidelines and standards is the language. But the intent, the overall intent of the document, and whether there is an enforcement mechanism is also a primary distinction.
Okay. David and Diane, you have listened to what Mary had to say. AFCC apparently took a different approach to this, and I wonder if you could respond to this distinction between the idea of guidelines and standards, and give us some idea as to why FCC decided standards were the way to go.
We've elected David to speak for us first.
Okay. We'll hear from David first.
The Americans with Disabilities Act has a provision that requires that accommodations be made for people with disabilities. And in light of my not yet quite diagnosed thought disorder, an arrangement was made tonight that I would be permitted to provide any answer that I felt was a good answer, whether or not it was responsive to the question. So with that in mind...
I'm sorry your time's up, David. Thank you very much.
Well, now I have to get to the right answer.
You may continue.
Lester Crawford, former commissioner of the Federal... of the Food and Drug Administration, has recently been indicted on two charges that involve holding stock in companies whose products are the subject of FDA approval. And the connection is, Mary makes reference to professional judgment. I am not here to poke fun at, well, I will poke fun at Lester Crawford, but I'm not here to poke fun at psychologists, social workers, other mental health professionals. But I wish to make the point that very, very frequently, our faith in professional judgment is profoundly misplaced. The whole reason for having guidelines, standards, and so on is to try and deal effectively with the people whose judgment is impaired. If everyone had superb judgment, Mary and I and anyone else working on these kinds of documents could issue a one-sentence declaration simply saying, use professional judgment, and no other details would need to be provided. The evidence abounds that our professional judgment is often lacking, and we need to have documents that are more specific. The other point that I would make in response to Mary is that Mary is discussing APA intent and not addressing the issue of what happens when those documents hit the real world. Three states in our country have declared the APA guidelines mandatory. And one of those states, Pennsylvania, faced a court challenge. And when it went to the state's highest court, the state's highest court ruled, not surprisingly, that when legislators go about the process of developing standards, they have a right to go wherever they choose to go to get the ideas for those standards. And even if the source of their ideas is a document clearly labeled guidelines, and even if the opening statements in that document clearly outline the intent of those who drew it up, that it be only guidelines, if the attitude of the legislators is, gee, this is really good stuff, and we should make it mandatory, then it is within their authority to make it mandatory. So that part of this debate about the importance or lack thereof of what we call the document is really being obscured. The reality is the outside world will take these documents, whether they're called practice parameters, guidelines, ethics codes, model standards, and the outside world will do with them as they see fit. I finished short.
I'm very impressed, Dave. Thank you. Would either of you want to follow up on his statements at all, or do you want to move on to the next set of questions?
Well, that's true, David, but which set would you rather have adopted by your legislature? And, of course, you're probably not a good person to ask that. a set that gives you some guidance and that might then be held up as a standard that's fairly loosely drawn and that sort of clearly says, if it's adopted as a standard in the legislature, as an enforceable law or rule of practice, that says the psychologist may wish to consider, or would you rather them adopt something that has roughly 250 declarative statements about what you will have done that almost nobody could possibly have fulfilled in any evaluation? No evaluation is perfect. There's always something that could have been done better. And when you provide a list to the enforcement mechanism of some 250 kinds of things that could be measured as failings, there are bound to be a good many. So I guess I would wonder, that's probably true. You're actually inviting legislatures to adopt the model standards. APA is asking legislatures to recognize that the guidelines are guidelines.
Thank you.
Quick response.
Okay.
Quick response, as you predicted, is that I prefer the tight language. And in the state of Florida, the wording of their immunity statute requires that you be attentive to the APA guidelines. One of those guidelines, for example, is that you be aware of personal biases. That, to me, is the kind of language that gets people in trouble, because how do you defend yourself against a complaint that you have not been aware of your personal biases? So I would rather deal with tight language where it's clear what is and what is not an infraction than have to contend with loose language.
Okay, thanks. Let's move to another question for a second. We may come back to this, but I want to move to another place. Again, for David and Diane's side to begin with. Diane, specifically, your job when litigating a custody dispute is to represent your client and kind of win the case for your client, get the result that they desire. Won't you use the model standards and their specificity to kind of undermine the testimony of an expert, even if you know that their conclusions and recommendations are in the best interest of children?
Well, I appreciate that you have faith that I and my brethren and sistren know what's in the best interest of children, whether or not there are custody evaluations. I don't think I have that level of certainty in my knowledge. So the presumption that I would substitute my judgment for either that of my client or that of a more experienced mental health professional who's trained to know is clearly not something I would jump into. It is, in fact, my job as an advocate for one of the parties, and of course sometimes my job is the advocate of the child, if I'm appointed to represent children, to represent their expressed wishes, if it's the adult, or to represent the totality of the best interest, depending on my role as, in my jurisdiction, minor's counsel, in some jurisdictions, law guardian or guardian ad litem. But that requires that I use evidence. Among the evidence I would use could be the custody evaluation. Would I use model standards to cross-examine? Of course I would. But just as David has addressed the fact that specificity makes it clearer, clarity isn't a bad thing. If I've got a law that says that I can prosecute somebody for exceeding the posted speed limit, and I have another law that says that I can prosecute somebody for driving at an unsafe speed, whether or not they've exceeded a posted speed limit is a much clearer and easier thing for me to determine whether they have or they haven't done. If I'm required to assess whether they've driven at an excessive speed, frankly, it's an easier job for the attorney because then I've got all kinds of other evidence I can use as the basis for my determination of whether they were exceeding the speed limit. Likewise, with a tightly drafted, well-worded, scientifically appropriate set of guidelines, I can determine whether or not, within the parameters given, assuming the parameters are appropriate, they've met those standards. The looser the language, the broader my ability to find what I need to find. I don't practice malpractice, but if I did, the looser language makes it easier.
Okay, thank you. Nancy, would you like to make some comments with respect to that?
I would. I'm going to have a field day with these standards. In fact, I would like to assign a squad of paralegals to design a big checklist, a light-up board, so I can check for each of these 250 directives. And then any report that would come into my office, we could go through it, and we could look and see if everything had been addressed, and we could start designing our cross-examination based on anything that was missing, anything that wasn't exactly what it was supposed to be. And we could do long cross-examinations that would go on and on and on with all the things that were missing. So I'm delighted about them in that respect.
Thank you. I don't know if I'm delighted to hear that answer, but thank you for the answer. Let me change again the direction a little bit here. David, there's a growing industry out there for custody evaluators to be litigation support people and consultants to attorneys. In fact, there are some evaluators whose sole employment is becoming to kind of on the one-sided side of critiquing evaluations and supporting the litigation process. I'd like you to comment on whether the model standards have given a boost to this industry.
Well, there are really two ways I could respond. One would be economically, and the other would be whether it makes the job easier. From an economic point of view, I'm reminded frequently by colleagues that when I bemoan the fact that there are people out there doing custody evaluations who don't know what they're doing, that it's the people who don't know what they're doing that's putting bread and butter on my table. So for economically, this industry, as you put it, is doing very nicely because there are people out there still making lots and lots of mistakes. And I say that if more people followed this document, fewer people would be making mistakes, and sooner or later, people like me would be out of business, which I'm perfectly comfortable with, by the way. Whether it makes the job easier to identify failings, I will go along with what was just said, that yes, it does become easier to make a list, to look for specific things, and to then point out to an attorney who has retained you, this was not done, that was not done, and so on. I don't see a problem with that. And unfortunately, my prime witness, who would have been Claude Schleuderer, is not here this evening. But Claude could have attested to the fact that I was taking a strong position in the state of New York while I was one of the people out there doing evaluations. I did a presentation for New York State Psych Association called A Call for Standards, and I was advancing this position that we need to be accountable. And again, going back to the issue of specificity, my feeling is that if rules are clear, then the only thing we really ought to be debating about is whether the rules are reasonable. My feeling is if the rules are clear, then everybody wins. And when I say everybody wins, I mean evaluators have a clear picture as opposed to an ambiguous picture of what's expected of them. The public has a clear picture of what can be expected from an evaluator. And judges and attorneys have a clear picture of what they ought to be looking for as they look at an evaluator's work. I don't see that as a bad thing for anyone, including the evaluators. And I don't think that there's anything in these model standards that is difficult for people to do. And by the way, in some situations where the work environment makes it difficult, people working within court-connected contexts where they're dealing with limited time, limited funds, we have made exceptions in certain areas. And it seems to me that these are not difficult things to follow. And I would point out that when we got complaints, as of course we did, not surprisingly, the vast majority of complaints had nothing to do with the standards. They had to do rather with the concept behind the standards, meaning we shouldn't be doing this. Very few people took issues with the specifics of the standards. Very few people said, I disagree with this model standard and here's why. I'm
okay.
On yellow.
You are yellow. You're at the yellow stage. Nancy, you want to respond to that?
Yes. Should we be doing this? Let's talk about that for a minute. I detect a note of hypocrisy in this discussion, and that is that these standards are aimed at empirical basis for all of this work, citations, all kinds of empirical evidence for these things. But let's talk about that applied to the task force. Are there, in fact, is there any empirical evidence that these guidelines are based on? How do we know what works? How can we have best practices if we can't even agree on what they should be, if we can't agree on how to decide which parenting plan would be better, which parent is more suitable? How do we know what we're talking about? How can we possibly have guidelines, or standards for that matter, on something without any empirical basis on its own? How can we require all of you to have an empirical basis for your report, yet these standards are not based on anything empirical, so far as I can tell from reading them? I think it implies, the existence of the standards imply a knowledge base that perhaps isn't there.
Okay, thank you. Did you want to add anything to that, Perry? Are you...
Yeah, I guess there are about five different directions I might like to go. I wanted to focus a little on David's comment about reasonableness, and to some extent, Nancy has touched on that very issue. There are some statements in the guidelines, and I'm speaking as in the standards. I'm speaking as Mary Connell and not as APA here. That I really can't find the empirical basis for. For example, I don't know whether it was an arbitrary decision or not that the first interview with litigant adults should be in person, at least the first one, and that others could conceivably be by telephone, and that all collateral contacts could be by telephone. And again, I don't know what the empirical basis is for that. It may seem sort of eminently reasonable to us and practical, but I'm not sure whether there's an empirical basis. And when you're setting it up as a standard for which somebody could lose their license by failing to comply with it, then I think we must take it very seriously whether there's a standard, whether there's an empirical basis for that standard. In terms of reasonableness, I think there are three or four places, and again, this is Mary Connell and not APA, three or four places in the model standards where new obligations are created for the evaluator that don't otherwise exist anywhere. For example, providing a written response when you're deciding to decline a case, a written response to the judge, a written statement of your decline and, I guess, the basis for your declining the case. And I don't know that there's any other place that that standard exists. So I think when these standards are creating new obligations for us, all of the professions involved need to take that very seriously. So I guess I do challenge the reasonableness and further haven't let go of the issue of specificity. There are some places in the model standards where the specificity still leaves plenty of argument. For example, the notion that that we must engage in, I guess, a thorough and impartial consideration of all factors in some respect. How does one decide when a thorough and impartial consideration of all rival hypotheses or whatever the issue was has been undertaken. That's something you can never do. You can never say, I considered every possible hypothesis from every possible angle. I did an incredibly thorough job of that. There's always something more you could have done. So I think when you get this specific and say all of these things need to have been done, that you create a number of problems for evaluators and a roadmap of an express line for a malpractice charge.
Thank you. I think what I'd like to do at this point is turn to Mary, wherever Mary is, and see if we have any questions from the floor that would like to be addressed to anyone. I see one here, but there's one back there too. You want to go there first?
Yeah, my question is, are there any plans to conduct any follow-up research on the outcome of custody decisions made based on these guidelines?
I'll do it to Diane and David.
This is somewhat similar to questions I used to get asked when I was an evaluator about the outcome of my recommendations and how many of them had been followed and whether or not they had gone well. There's certain research that unfortunately we're unable to do, and we're unable to do it simply because we have no compared to what position. We have no way of doing a controlled experiment, and we have no way of knowing whether when people start following, I'll still call it guidance that's in these model standards, whether it will result in an appreciable improvement in the quality of reports, and if so, how we would ascertain that. The reason, by the way, that I still refer to it as guidance is because there's a step in this process that I feel is being blurred over. I understand, primarily through conversations with Arnie, that in the state of Pennsylvania, when the decision was made to turn the APA guidelines into enforceable standards, there was no adequate public discussion and so on. They just went ahead and did it. And my reaction with that would be that people's gripes are with the process by which this occurred. When Mary talks about obligations, my reaction is to remind people that no one is obligated to follow these. I'm not
David,
even...
David, I assume you're going beyond his question.
No, it's part of his question,
okay.
Because
okay.
It relates to the degree to which we can do a study of what happens when people start following this.
Okay.
Can we obligate people to follow this? We can't obligate people to follow this unless and until regulatory boards decide that it is something that will be governed by regulation. Then we might be in a better position to see what will happen. But while it is still guidance, and here's the connection, it may be that the people who choose to follow the guidance are different than the people who choose to ignore it. So if the quality of work is improving, I would love to take credit and say it's the model standards that we developed that's resulting in this improvement. But even if there were measurable improvement, it might be more a statement about the people who are voluntarily choosing to follow what's in this document.
Okay, thank you. Do you feel you have any responses?
Well, just briefly, the educational value of the model standards, the power, the wonder-working power of the model standards. I have to acknowledge there's a tremendous amount of good information in there. I read through them today again, then read through the existing child custody guidelines, and all the same guidance is there, all the same educational value is there, almost without exception, without any of the shalls or shoulds. I'm going to assume that a shall is a should in masquerade. And so I think all of the educative power can be embodied in guidelines without the enforcement sort of strategy that the standards sets up.
Thank you.
Thinking about Nancy's field day cross-examining the 250 declarative statements, I'm wondering if you could speak to the difference between standards and model standards, and particularly in light of cross-examination.
Well, okay. Since it's in light of cross-examination, we're giving that to Diana.
I can only do this by analogy because the American Bar Association has promulgated model standards for professional conduct, which are intended to be suggestions for the various jurisdictions, and I think all but two have adopted them as their standards. The difference being that model standards allow for tweaking. They allow for the jurisdictions to accept but perhaps make some changes when being adopted by their respective legislatures to accommodate specific needs they may have. I mean, I can't think of what they might be in these circumstances, but that would be the difference between a model standard and a standard. If we were promulgating standards, we would have the power to enforce, as Mary indicated. Since we don't have enforcement power, since the preliminary statements of our model standards indicate that they are not intended to be something that AFCC would enforce against or on behalf of AFCC members, we're promulgating a model to be used to be adopted by legislatures.
For the purpose of cross-examination, it doesn't really make that much difference to me if they're adopted, not adopted. Let me show you what we mean. Ms. Witness, would you please take the stand? You're a member of AFCC, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
And you're familiar with the model standards of practice for custody evaluators?
Yes, indeed.
In fact, you attended the most recent AFCC conference in Atlanta, where you participated in a dynamic and fascinating program concerning the model standards, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And you're aware that the standards were promulgated by a multidisciplinary group of child custody professionals?
Yes.
That they evolved through 8 drafts?
Yes.
That they included extensive input, 600 written comments?
Yes, indeed.
And 200 oral comments?
Yes.
At 3 public meetings?
Yes.
And I want to call your attention to, and you can see how this is going to go along.
Mary, I can handle that if you can't. I'm the one on the spot.
Okay. Do you feel you got an answer to your question?
No, there is a difference. Okay.
She said she didn't Robin think there Reed. Was a difference between model standards and standards.
Yeah. In the January issue of Family Court Review, the model standards will be published along with an introduction and a foreword. And in the foreword, I offered my own non-legal definition of model standards, and it is model standards are good ideas for standards. And that's really what model standards are. And it really simply gets back to the issue of when legislators search for ideas, where are they going to look? And we're basically saying to them, while you're looking around for drafting rules, take a look at these. We think they're good. That, in essence, is what the document is saying. And with regard to, can I respond to Nancy's question? Can I respond to the question about, you know, you were there? I'm the reporter, so I should certainly be able to say, even I don't feel obligated to follow these things. But what I do feel obligated to do, and I feel everyone ought to be obligated to do, is explain why. If there's something on this list you disagree with, why do you disagree with it? If you don't disagree with it, then why didn't you do it that way? That, to me, is perfect logic. And I feel any cross-examining attorney has a right to go after somebody using that reasoning. Either this is good, one particular one, or it's not. If it's good, why didn't you do it that way? If it's not good, explain to us why you feel it's not good.
Nancy, could I ask you to respond to that from the standpoint, I'd like you to respond to it in whatever way you were going to, but also from the standpoint of, as a cross-examining attorney in that situation, how much credibility would you give to this AFCC member who's arguing against his own standards as being not good?
Well, I think it's problematic. I know that the standards do provide for people to explain why they departed from them. But once I've got you on the witness stand and you're trying to explain why you departed, you're already on the defensive, and I can keep you going in that direction. And it's an issue that otherwise wouldn't be raised. Another aspect of this, even though they're model standards, is that for malpractice purposes, You're all familiar that you have a duty. It's defined in different ways, but something to do with the skill, care, and knowledge possessed by other members of your professional community. And when something's embodied in a standard form like this, adopted by a prestigious group like this, that starts to sound to me like it's a standard.
So if I may follow up then with you from that place, are you saying that AFCC members are going to be more vulnerable to malpractice complaints?
Definitely.
As a function of this?
They're going to be, I think it embodies a standard that people are going to be held to. It's evidence of a standard. It's evidence of breach of that duty of care that everybody's required to do. If you're not meeting that, I think you're in some potential danger. Now, people may have, one of the things that comes up with this is the fact that people may well have immunity. And I note on the program there's going to be an excellent session on immunity, and I encourage you all to go. You may need to know about that. And it's good for you if you are appointed by a court order and named by name and all that kind of thing. But failure to follow, what if, for instance, you're not appointed in a court order? You may, in fact, not have immunity, depending. What if you don't follow these guidelines? Are you acting in bad faith? Much immunity is conferred only when you're acting in good faith. Could be evidence of that. We don't know.
Okay.
May I add just a couple of comments to what she said, just to sort of...
Yes, and then I'll let Diane respond.
Okay. Before there's a rush to resign your membership in AFCC, let me just say that being outside of AFCC will not protect you from that malpractice litigation. The former AFCC model standards have been cited, and anybody who's doing child custody work is kind of expected in court to know them, to be familiar with them, and to be able to explain why any departure from them might have occurred. I don't think that you necessarily are immune just because you're not a member of AFCC. And I had another thought, but I'll go ahead and stay with the subject.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, let me follow up on what Mary is saying. I'm not limited to using a list of standards in cross-examining an expert witness on the stand. If AFCC promulgates standards by which evaluators choose to conduct themselves in evaluations, it may be a good idea. I can use this list. I could have used this list in its first incarnation if I wanted to, if I thought that conducting evaluations in a particular way was a good way and I wanted to cross-examine evaluators who've never seen this thing before to find out why they didn't do each of the 250 things. Because if they should have been doing it because it was a good idea before, the fact that it's a standard or not a standard doesn't change whether it's good practice or not good practice. It may, in fact, be the standard of care in their community already, but it certainly isn't going to limit my cross-examination. All this does is it gives them a good model by which to insulate themselves from bad cross-examination.
So you're saying that's how it helps them?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Can I address the malpractice problem?
You may ask. Certainly.
Eric Marine and Margaret Bogey, both of whom are affiliated with the American Professional Agency, that up until I forget what year was the sole carrier for psychologists, have gathered a great deal of data on malpractice issues. And they have a continuing ed course that's offered online. And Marine and Bogey have made the point very emphatically that what is called the standard of care is determined in the courtroom in each individual case, not by any specific document, and that more often than not, the controlling factor is the persuasiveness of each expert. The expert for the plaintiff is going to come in and say, you departed from a standard of care, you should have done this or should not have done that. The expert representing the defendant is going to come in and say, absolutely not, there's nothing wrong with what so-and-so did, and there's nothing that should have been done that wasn't done. And it's really a question of which of these people is more believable. I will not deny that sometimes what makes a person more persuasive is the ability to hold a document in the air and wave it and point to it and refer to it. But that these kinds of documents, according to Marine and Bogey, are not critical in the decisions that then come down concerning what constitutes the standard of care.
Mary, you said you had some other comments. Do you want to make those now?
Well, yes. Nancy mentioned that if you're thoughtful and know what you're doing, that you can probably survive a malpractice complaint. That's right, but there's a tremendous cost to that litigation. There's a cost economically. There's a cost in terms of time. There's a cost in terms of your emotional well-being, and there's a cost in terms of your career. I mean, having a number of malpractice complaints doesn't do you any good when you're on the witness stand. You're going to have to explain it again and again and again, even if you're exonerated. And everybody here has agreed that the model standards provide a roadmap for litigation. They provide a set of criteria, a very specific set of criteria by which to evaluate a person's work. So a good person doing good work may still not do all of the things that are identified here and may still need to be persuasive in court and explain why not. And that's costly. The other cost of this is the number of people who drop out of doing custody evaluations because the bar has been set so high that it's virtually impossible to do it and remain, free of liability, and the populations that don't get served, both by virtue of fewer people being willing to do it and by virtue of the standard being set so high that in order for an evaluation to be a proper evaluation, it involves some 30 or 40 hours of time, and at the fees that we charge gets increasingly expensive, so that it becomes something that's only for the most, resourceful litigants. And so I think there are some costs here and some implications that really need to be taken very seriously when you prescribe a set of behaviors for a service instead of having a continuum. Now, I understand that David has indicated that the mini-eval and the early neutral eval and some of the court-ordered evaluations that are more constrained are presumed to fall outside of the purview of these standards. But in actuality, if you're out there in practice and you do one of those assessments, you're still, if you're making any kind of recommendation about custody or access, about parenting time and responsibility, you still can and probably will be held accountable to these model standards. So I think it really will shape the field. It will have an impact that's a bit frightening to me.
Okay. I've heard an argument that AFCC should be doing more to protect its members rather than setting them up for these types of things. This kind of brings us into an argument or a discussion of whether AFCC as a guild should be more oriented towards that side. It's almost as if, Diane, going back to what you said earlier, do I want to set standards for my intoxicated drivers that are perhaps better for public safety but not necessarily going to keep them out of jail? How do you respond to that? With a book?
Can I read from my cheat sheet? If you go to the AFCC website, you will find under mission statement three different categories: mission, vision, and values. You will find phrases such as improving the lives of children and families, serving the needs of children, identifying best practices, achieve the best possible outcome for children and families. Under values, there's a reference to the needs of families and children in conflict. There is not one single reference here to protecting the membership. And I feel that that's exactly the way it ought to be. And by the way, for those that are psychologists, if you look at the APA mission statement, it refers to advancing psychology as a science and profession. And I would point out that there's a tremendous difference between advancing a profession and protecting the members of that profession. And I would also say that it's easy for us to see this when it's not us that we're looking at. When we're looking outward, it's easy for us to see that law enforcement would be better if we weeded out the bad cops, that medical practice would be better if we weeded out the impaired physicians, but no one wants to look at the fact that maybe custody evaluation as a profession would be better if we weeded out the bad custody evaluators. It's easy to look outward, it's more painful to look inward, but I don't think that a mission statement should simply be babble that gets put in a document that no one really believes in. If we believe in these words, then the emphasis is on children, not on self-protection. This is not a trade union.
Okay. I don't know. Apparently it was. given that act to follow. Mary?
Well, I don't know that I necessarily perceive the interests of the members of either organization to be at odds with the interests of the people the organization serves. I think if we all have our eye on the ball for delivering quality services that are well-informed and that aim at and hit the target of the needs of the people being served, then it's a win-win. And in fact, the guidelines evaluation process in APA does look very specifically at whether lower SES people are underserved, whether underserved communities are poorly served by the guidelines, whether the guidelines address sort of human factors, address people's rights, all of the issues that I think you embrace that would concern you about the focus of the guidelines are embodied in the APA process for evaluating guidelines. So while it may not be upfront and clear as a mission statement, and that may be a shortcoming, I certainly appreciate everything that you said about the importance of the organization not just being self-serving and not just being there to advance its own members. I don't see that it would be easy to argue that that's what APA is all about.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, it's now 8, so I want to turn again and see if we have some... now we're getting some hands. Here we go. What's that?
Here we are. We had lots of hands. You just were turned around.
Well, you can yell at me. Okay.
I'm Lorraine Martin, and I'm co-chair with Bill of the task force. I want to respond to a comment that you made, Mary. I haven't had the pleasure of meeting you, but I've heard wonderful things about you, that the standards may preclude a certain population. AFCC, in its wisdom or mistake, purposely appointed me as co-chair with all of these forensic types. I'm a social worker, and I run a public service in Ontario, Canada. We do 1,600 new custody evaluations per year. That's a fairly large population, maybe second only to California. I can tell you that Deb Kulik, who runs the service in Connecticut, and myself were totally reassured every step of the way and made certain that our services were protected. So the court service model can meet these standards and should meet these standards.
Okay, Lorraine, thank you for the comment, but I need to be the moderator and say that we need questions, not comments, for our debaters.
Oops. But we like that one.
First, thank you for all your work. I think this is a very interesting conversation. I want to go back to the title of the presentation. Are AFCC model standards a help or a hindrance? And I come to for whom? Because what I hear being talked about here today is what do we call it, how do we use it, is it enforceable, and how can it be used against us? What I don't hear talking about and what I would like to hear focused on is the relevancy of these rules. We are a profession in its infancy moving towards something. And just like law has rules of evidence and rules of civil procedure, what I hear is this document being an attempt at setting a set of rules that can move us forward. And that will be revised. And I guess I'm curious about whether or not you folks see an analogy between the development of these rules and the development in law of rules of evidence and rules of civil procedure that help guide the professional behavior so that we can maximally serve the public.
Diane, you want to respond to that first?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would say, and I guess I'll approach it from the help end, looking at it from the perspectives of the people who would ultimately use the product. Do these guidelines help evaluators? I would argue that they do. They give you a core set of ways, and not so specific as to limit nuance or change personality or the way that a particular evaluator wants to do things, because there's a broad range of ways to do it right by using these guidelines. But this allows an evaluator to cover a lot of bases and to essentially have a checklist of how to do that. Does it help attorneys? Of course it helps attorneys. It helps attorneys not just for cross-examination purposes for those who screw up, but for those of us who want to examine an evaluator whose report, the results of which we like, it allows us to support your product because there's some basis, some substance for the work that you've done. We who don't go to 4 years of graduate school can see how you got to where you got because you used a process that was supportable and understandable by us. Does it help judicial officers? It clearly helps judicial officers because judicial officers can measure the quality of the product that you produce as an evaluator by seeing the way that you got there through a standardized process that met essentially Kelly Fry standards or Daubert standards in getting to the place that you got. Does it help litigants? Clearly it helps litigants because part of the standards requires that there be explanation, that there be clarity, that the process be transparent. So litigants will understand how you got to where you got. They are already in a process whether there are standards or not, but these standards allow them to understand, and my understanding of the litigants' appreciation of the process is helped tremendously when they understand how you got there, even if the result is against them.
I'll let Nancy go. There you go. Okay.
I think these are more like the rules of professional responsibility for lawyers than they would be the rules of evidence. The rules of evidence and some of the associated running of the court kinds of rules were developed really over hundreds of years and have been more recently codified. But those are things that have gone on for a long time, have served the test of time, been reconsidered over and over and over again, are constantly being refined by the courts. And I would go back to the question here about the empirical basis for these. Do we know what the basis is for these rules?
Please hold on 1 second.
Let me pick up with empirical basis. And I will read to you from Federal Rule of Evidence 702 as amended on April 17th of 2000. Expert testimony must be based upon sufficient facts or data, must be the product of reliable principles and methods, and must be offered by a witness who has applied the principles and methods reliably to the facts of the case. That's empirical. That's what the rule says. There's no debate about what the rule says. And my point is that a lot of what's dealt with in this document is really nothing more than a reminder to mental health professionals that we're not playing in our own ballpark. We're playing in somebody else's ballpark. We're playing in a legal arena where the rules are different, where we have to understand that what we do needs to be reliable and valid, that we have to understand basic principles of due process, so that, for example, if a collateral source tells you a story that casts someone in a negative light, that person has an opportunity to respond. This is basic due process stuff. This is empirical stuff. We're not telling people how to judge best interests. We're not telling people what instruments to use. We're simply saying when you choose instruments, keep in mind that the Federal Rule of Evidence says they have to be reliable and valid. So that basically we're simply doing what I feel ought to be done. When reference is made to putting a witness on the defensive, and I say, I don't have any problem with that, we ought to be able to comfortably defend our choices of instruments, our choices of methodology. If we've chosen to use a particular instrument, it's appropriate that a cross-examining attorney ask us what the basis was for that choice, and it's appropriate that we bear the burden of explaining that choice. I don't think there's anything out of line about any of this.
Okay. Did you want to respond one more time, Nancy?
Quickly, these go well beyond due process. They are rather procedural in nature, but they extend well beyond what a court would require in terms of due process. What I have been trying to say is that are these standards grounded in valid scientific principles and methods? If we apply Daubert and Fry to these standards, would they pass?
Thank you.
Got another one over here.
Hi. This may be an unfair question to anybody other than Diana, who's from California, but California has rules of court, 5.220, 5.225, that define custody evaluations and experience and training requirements, etc. Do you have any sense, anybody on the panel who may know from that, but I mean, so I'm focusing first on Diana, being from California, whether, and I'll use the title here, whether those rules of court have been a help or a hindrance for the 6 years that they've been in practice or in enforcement? Because if we have a sense from California's practice with rules of court, it may help us understand this question 6 years down the road here. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, as you know, the California rules are ones that were used as part of what we modeled in preparing these model standards. 6 years is not a long time, so I can't say, other than my own anecdotal information, how that's gone. I'm not aware of any formal studies to determine whether, you know, people have dropped out of the biz or hopped on board because of or in spite of those additional rules.
Okay. Next question.
I'm just reviewing the, I think this is a very impressive piece of work, and I just wanted to address a couple of things here. It looks like that the, according to these standards, the evaluator is under the responsibility to generate data reflecting, let's see, assessment of parents and parenting figures, assessment of children, assessment of adult-child relationships, and they shall use empirically based methods and procedures of data collection. This presumes that there are available empirically based methods and procedures of data collection. So I would suggest, I was directing this question to Dr. Martindale and his team to provide us with some information concerning the availability of empirically developed methods and procedures for assessing these domains.
I think that part of what we have to acknowledge, both in response to your question and in response to Nancy's observation, is that we don't have empirical data for everything. Where empirical data are available, we should be relying upon the empirical data and not ignoring the empirical data. And one example I would give would be there is clear research reported in respected journals about good ways and bad ways to interview children. Ways in which to get information from children without the interview process being suggestive and so on. And so part of what we mean when we talk about empirical approaches is things of that sort. We're not talking about a specific test that will measure that one parent is more suitable than another and that any such test exists and that there's empirical evidence to support the contention that it does this job. I would say quite the opposite. I don't think there's any single test out there that answers the questions that need to be answered in a thorough custody evaluation.
So in the way you responded to that question, and maybe I'll ask it at this side, has he supported your argument that the standards are not always empirically based and may set up a catch-22?
Exactly. You know, you can't possibly do it because the tools aren't there. I agree, David, that it's important not to ignore empirical data that's there, but we must recognize the importance of clinical judgment while that still is one of the most important tools we have in these assessments. If I focus only on the available empirical data and look only at, for example, test results that have been validated for child custody outcome and ignore some of the more mushy kind of clinical judgment observations that I might have, I feel like I come up very short in a custody evaluation. So it's important to maintain that balance. So I think when you make declarative statements like the one that the gentleman pointed out, then the evaluator is extremely vulnerable.
Okay, another question.
They didn't tell me I was going to be running around, so I've got high heels on. I didn't bring flats.
Thank you. I have a question, and that is that can the panel concede that there are any standard expectations of behavior in custody evaluators? For example, should we be objective and neutral? I mean, can I get a standard?
I think I'm the one that needs to do some conceding.
Go ahead.
Of course. Good questions. I think we could have a private discussion after this about what all I would concede to in the model standards. But I'm here as APA, and I just would say that the ethics code, also in specialty guidelines for forensic practice, there are a number for forensic psychologists, the old, the existing APA child custody guidelines, all of those set almost every one of the goals that the model standards embody. The model standards do go, as my debate partner Nancy said, they go far beyond due process and far beyond where all of those other documents go to very, very specific kinds of things, such as that, you know, you should obtain in writing from collateral sources consent to cite them, or that you should list in your report the collateral sources who decide not to participate, who don't return your phone calls, or perhaps who return your phone call and leave a message saying why they don't want to participate. So I think there are some issues here, and John introduced the idea of revision, and I think that's an exciting concept because, indeed, the model standards have now been launched, and they're out there, and so I hope there will be some opportunities for finding out what their impact is, as Phil mentioned, and seeing whether there's any revision, any tweaking that is needed to bring them back down to earth.
Well, one of the questions that raises was actually a question I was going to in this, is that it seems as though AFCC specifically said that these standards were out there for regulatory bodies to endorse and to perhaps incorporate for regulation. If your argument or your statement is that, well, these are out there now and we may need to revise them, or there's always a need for ongoing revision, what are the odds of a regulatory board revising them because we've revised them? And I don't know if any of you have that question, have that answer. I doubt the state of Pennsylvania is going to revise the child custody guidelines.
You know, sometimes state boards in the rules of practice for psychologists, sometimes state boards simply point to a document that is considered to be endorsed by the state board, such as the APA ethics code. It doesn't actually include all of the language into the rules of practice for that state. So if the ethics code gets updated in 2002, the reference to the ethics code still prevails, is still good. So I'm not sure. But I do think the three states that you've mentioned may have actually taken the language from the child custody guidelines and made the language its own. So when we revise the child custody guidelines, the process that's underway, I don't know whether those three states will then need to revise their.
Mary, I just want to return to the point you made previously. The debate tonight is not about any specific standard, and I recognize that. But since you raised the issue of a whole thing about all kinds of stuff that we say ought to be in writing, those in this room who are on the custody listserv will know that in the last several days, there was a subject line entitled Collateral Reneges on Permission to Use Interview. And the whole discussion was what happens when someone gives you information and then suddenly says, oh, but I don't want you to use that information. One of the points that we're making is that when agreements are written, these kinds of problems are done away with. And that, again, our point is that everybody wins. There are no losers. The collateral source knows what the rules are because they're in writing. You don't have a problem where issues are raised in court where something that has been said may now have to be retracted. Everything is simplified by the fact that it's been spelled out in writing. And one of the people who participated in this discussion made mention of the fact that somewhat fewer people are giving him information these days when he sends out things in writing. And my response to that would be, if that is true, it tells you something. And what it tells you is that when people have the time to sit down with a written document, read it carefully, contemplate the implications, some of them will say, no, I don't want to do this. And that is their right.
And part of the problem we have is that sometimes we get so impressed with the importance of our work that we don't want to give them that right. Our feeling is, hey, I've got an important job to do, and in order to do it right, I need information from you. So I don't want you saying, no, I'm sorry, now that I've read all this, I don't want to do it. But it's people's right to say I don't want to do it.
Okay. Another question?
Thanks. This is a question for Mary. Since you said that the APA guidelines and the AFCC model standards are, for the most part, substantively the same, and since they've been out there for 10 or more years, both AFCC's original model standards and APA's guidelines, and I think everyone in this room would acknowledge that there's some very bad work out there, despite the fact that 10 years of these guidelines and model standards have existed, isn't this, having this these model standards set, a help and a safety net for custody evaluators to have those 250 declarative statements that they can go through and use as a blueprint for doing good work?
It's possible that good will come of it. I think the same good will come of David publishing an article saying, you know, this is what I consider to be best practices. I think a well-reasoned article that gets well-circulated and frequently cited has the same educative value. When everybody becomes aware that this is kind of the yardstick by which they will be measured, yes, it is possible that now some people will read something that wouldn't have read a peer-reviewed article. So it is possible that it will reach more ears and have some impact. I think the impact it has, however, can be fairly far-reaching. It's not just the educative impact that it has, whereas a publication in a peer-reviewed article may be principally educative and a little less sort of litigation promoting. So in that sense, I would suggest that if everything that is in these model standards is exactly correct, a white paper establishing this as best practice would have been just as effective and had fewer potential implications that could conceivably hurt evaluators.
Thank you.
Now I have two more.
I'm asking this question out of sheer ignorance. Is in the bylaws of the organization, are there rules that when you make these model standards, in spite of all the review that you've gotten and all the comments, who ends up deciding that they are, in fact, as of May 2006, effective? Is that a decision of the executive board?
The board
or
of
does
directors.
The membership vote on it? I just don't know that. It's a process question.
Why doesn't Mary answer that question?
Mary, you can answer it.
It's my understanding, and Peter, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that once the board adopts these, they become effective standards for the community. So I think it's once the board adopts them. They were recommendations from the task force. The task force made the recommendations to the board, and then the board adopted them. Am I? Peter, are you nodding? Thank you. Peter doesn't have a voice, and it's really exciting, so we can just ask him questions.
There's a question behind him.
I know. And it's a question.
It is a question. I've been sitting here wondering, why are we talking about this now that the barn door is closed? The horse is in the pasture. The standards have been written. Why are we discussing whether or not this was a good idea?
The discussion in, I'll answer that as moderator of this. The discussion isn't whether it was a good idea. It really was to help give voice to the question of what is helpful about it, what may not be helpful about it, to our membership.
I'm sorry.
Two very brief questions. The third state that's in the three states that has adopted the APA standards, Pennsylvania, Florida, and the third state,
South Carolina.
Thank you. And my last quick question is, will there be a declaratory statement system that will be in place with AFCC? So if there is some clarity that is needed, I see Mary getting ready to nod, but will you have that in place if we have an issue and request a declaratory statement from AFCC regarding the model standards?
Go ahead.
As far as I know, we haven't thought that far ahead. I think that's an excellent
question, and it's kind of indirectly a statement, not a question, but it's a good one. I do think we ought to have some way of responding to people's questions about those aspects of the model standards that have some, I'll call it, built-in and deliberate ambiguity. And I will point out, by the way, that despite my occasional rants in favor of specificity, that there has to be some room for ambiguity. There has to be some room for individual judgment. And so again, I mean, I mount this strong argument against blindly trusting individual judgment, but we also have to make some allowances for it. And with respect, for example, to some of the things that Mary said about in-person interviews, I hate to say this, but Mary didn't read from the model standards. There are words like, except when special circumstances arise, or things of that sort. What that simply means is that if you do it without an in-person interview, then the burden is on you, as I feel it should be, to explain what the special circumstances were that caused you to interview people without seeing them in person. Doesn't mean you can't do it. It means it's now your job to explain why. But I'm not sure how it'll be worked out. And at the risk of making it sound as though I'm just trying to make more work for me to do, I mean, certainly I think part of what will come of this is that there will be future meetings at which there will be future discussions about the model standards, including portions that people may find not sufficiently clear, things of that sort. But I still feel on balance, obviously, my feeling is that it will be beneficial, that more people will be attentive to it than would have been simply to a paper, however well written, however, you know, well circulated, and that it will boost the level of practice. I really hope for that.
Thanks.
We need to wrap up now because it is getting to be that time, and we promised final statements.
First of all, I want to thank all of you for taking the time and energy to be up here doing this. And if any of you now would like to make a statement regarding out-of-role situations, please do so.
Me first. I had a very difficult task tonight. I couldn't agree more with virtually every aspect of the model standards in terms of them being best practice. There are a few little things that I might argue with, and I specifically didn't participate in the feedback and the posting of drafts because I wanted to wait for this. Because of my role at AFCC and COPS. But these are a fine set of standards, and if standards must be had, a better job probably could hardly have been done. I do think that there may be opportunities for a few revisions, a very few kind of minor revisions, but also for research. It's an exciting first step, as John mentioned, for establishing a kind of baseline. This is where we're agreed is kind of the idea for at least the Cadillac of custody evaluations, and where we have to depart because circumstances require us to or limit us. We have to be thoughtful about why we're departing and be able to articulate the reasons, as the standards so clearly say, and as David has said tonight. So in general, as I knew from watching David's work over the years and knowing AFCC, I knew these would be good model standards, and they are. APA still has the issue of whether model standards were needed. And for APA members, they might not have been, because our guidelines really do address almost exactly the same issues. But APA does not offer those guidelines for all professions. They are intended for psychologists, and these standards address the needs of a number of professions. So in general, I would just say job well done.
I want to second that. It was fun playing the devil's advocate, but I really do think the standards are very well done, very complete, and I think will advance the profession. And don't lose any sleep about all this, because I think everybody's going to be fine.
Okay. Well, thank you all for coming.
There is...